Chapter 1. A Shameless Worship of Heroes. Of the many ideals which in youth gave life a meaning and radiance missing from the chilly perspectives of middle age, one at least has remained with me as bright and satisfying as ever before: the shameless worship of heroes. In an age that would level everything and reverence nothing, I take my stand with Victorian Carlyle and light my candles like Mirandola before Plato's image at the shrines of great men. I say shameless, for I know how unfashionable it is now to acknowledge in life or history any genius loftier than ourselves. Our democratic dogma has leveled not only all voters, but all leaders. We delight to show that living geniuses are only mediocrities, and that dead ones are myths. If we may believe historian H.G. Wells, Caesar was a numbskull and Napoleon a fool. Since it is contrary to good manners to exalt ourselves, we achieve the same result by slyly indicating how inferior are the great men of the earth. In some of us, perhaps, it is a noble and merciless asceticism, which would root out of our hearts the last vestige of worship and adoration, lest the old god should return and terrify us again. For my part, I cling to this final religion, and discover in it a content and stimulus more lasting than came from the devotional ecstasies of youth. How natural it seemed to greet the great Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore by that title which so long had been given him by his countrymen, Guru Deva, revered master. For why should we stand reverent before waterfalls and mountaintops, or a summer moon on a quiet sea, and not before the highest miracle of all, a man who is both great and good? So many of us are mere talents, clever children in the play of life, that when genius stands in our presence, we can only bow down before it as an act of God, a continuance of creation. Such men are the very lifeblood of history, to which politics and industry are but frame and bones. Part cause of the dry scholasticism from which we were suffering when James Harvey Robinson summoned us to humanize our knowledge was a conception of history as an impersonal flow of figures and facts in which genius played so inessential a role that histories prided themselves upon ignoring them. It was to Karl Marx above all that this theory of history was due. It was bound up with a view of life that distrusted the exceptional man, envied superior talent, and exalted the humble as the inheritors of the earth. In the end, men began to write history as if it had never been lived at all, as if no drama had ever walked through it, no comedies or tragedies of struggling or frustrated men. The vivid narratives of Gibbon and Taine gave way to ash heaps of irrelevant erudition, in which every fact was correct, documented, and dead. No, the real history of man is not in prices and wages, nor in elections and battles, nor in the even tenor of the common man. It is in the lasting contributions made by geniuses to the sum of human civilization and culture. The history of France is not, if one may say it with all courtesy, the history of the French people, the history of those nameless men and women who tilled the soil, cobbled the shoes, cut the cloth, and peddled the goods, for these things have been done everywhere and always. The history of France is the record of her exceptional men and women, her inventors, scientists, statesmen, poets, artists, musicians, philosophers, and saints, and of the additions which they made to the technology and wisdom, the artistry and decency, of their people and mankind. And so with every country, so with the world. Its history is properly the history of its great men. What are the rest of us but willing brick and mortar in their hands that they may make a race a little finer than ourselves? Therefore, I see history not as a dreary scene of politics and carnage, but as the struggle of man through genius with the obdurate inertia of matter and the baffling mystery of mind, the struggle to understand, control, and remake himself and the world. I see men standing on the edge of knowledge and holding the light a little farther ahead, men carving marble into forms ennobling men, men molding peoples into better instruments of greatness, men making a language of music and music out of language, men dreaming of finer lives and living them. Here is a process of creation more vivid than in any myth, a godliness more real than in any creed. To contemplate such men, to insinuate ourselves through study into some modest discipleship to them, to watch them at their work and warm ourselves at the fire that consumes them, this is to recapture some of the thrill that youth gave us when we thought, at the altar or in the confessional, that we were touching or hearing God. In that dreamy youth, we believed that life was evil, and that only death could usher us into paradise. We were wrong. Even now, while we live, we may enter it. Every great book, every work of